And then someone went,
testing, 1, 2.
I can really taste the bacteria.
What's up, John? What's up, John Burton?
1, 2, 3, 4. Why you can't have a best?
Okay, wait. Let me rewind. John, you're right.
Right. I'm just going to play us in a little bit.
When are you going to tell me we're starting?
We started.
Okay. Awesome.
Welcome. So that was my morning.
And that was after surviving 2 days of changing the strings on your guitar.
Oh, that's yeah. That's the guitar accident.
I was wondering.
Oh, cool. Because what happened? You play?
No, I managed to survive for my music therapy degree, you had to play the guitar, which I sort of understand. I personally would prefer they recommend the ukulele, but it's just smaller. And so I managed to con my way through, I think it was either 2 or 4 credits on the guitar. I was just like...
But you didn't like it?
Oh, no, I don't like guitars particularly. I like classical guitar, but I don't like the feeling of the strings on my fingers.
Mm.
You know, and I've thought about this a lot because I play the piano and I sing. Right. And I used to play the clarinet when... fingers that were generally in much better shape. But the problem with clarinets, like, it's a melody line instrument. There was 2 problems, one of which you need other people to play with, and yep. 2, you can't sing at the same time.
Right.
Whereas with the piano,
right,
I can just play very simple, you know, chord sequences and sing. And the whole thing is about connecting to, sorry, my piano's here and the kids are over there.
Right.
You know, or the... seniors are over there. So the important thing is connecting to the other person, not about necessarily doing pyrotechnics on my instrument.
Right, right.
So everything that I do is with that in mind, which is using your music to help other people.
Mm-hmm.
So bit by bit, you can not only teach people a whole bunch of wonderful songs because there's gazillions out there, but you can encourage them to get away from being self-conscious, like, oh, I played a wrong note. Well, whoopie-doop, you know.
Right.
And then you can get into more important things, which is you believing and you feeling that your music that you have inside of you is really important, and to share it with other people, like you're giving a gift from you to them, is the most important thing in the world. Is it nice to have whizzy fingers? Of course it is. But that's not the most important thing.
And I are on the same page on whizzy fingers.
Which is why, of course, it's good to have good equipment, which isn't always possible. But that's not the number one goal. The number one goal is digging inside yourself, quote, deeper and deeper, to hear the music that you've heard, you've picked up along your way, that you have inside you, but you often don't know that you do have inside you.
Mm.
So therefore, as you continue to connect with yourself, you can, it's kind of like doing a bit of mining. You bring that forth to other people, and 'cause that's the intention.
Which is why they make you play guitar for art therapy.
Yes.
Because guitar, or for music therapy rather, this is just a dumb theory. I don't know, but I do believe this. So you vibrate, right? You have a vibration.
Yeah,
everybody has a vibration.
Because of the voice.
Yeah,
yes,
yeah. Or even, and you're electric, and your heart's a battery, and it's got a vibration.
Yeah.
Guitar is a percussion instrument. You have to hit it to make noise, so it vibrates.
Yes.
Right? So the combination of it vibration and your vibration, to me, is like holding a living thing because it's vibrating. Like if I was holding you, right? So I think there's a therapeutic element to that, to holding something that's vibrating and vibrating against you.
Oh, totally. My curiosity is, why don't you do a ukulele? It's only got four strings and it's much easier to play and it's much smaller.
You need a bigger vibration.
So if you if you talk about holding something and feeling its vibration, the ukulele is significantly friendlier. You know, and also obviously if you're walking out and about with music therapy equipment, then you know you want something that's very portable, and ukuleles and guitars are highly portable.
Yeah, that's true.
I just recently I bought the piano because the piano at the facility was literally on its last legs, and then you're at the mercy of the administration, and we all know what that means. That means could they afford to buy it for you? Yes. Will they?
No.
No.
Right.
So I decided I was not going to be at the mercy of the administration, and I was going to buy a piano for the facility.
Right.
And I went.
Which facility?
It's the part. It's in Millbrook.
Okay.
It's called the Fountains.
Okay.
And so they're all at the mercy of the corporations.
Yeah.
The headquarters are in Arizona. It's part of the Watermark communities, whatever. So I decided that, so I went to speak to the Vincitor, John Vincitor in Poughkeepsie, Vincitor Pianos. And I told him what I wanted to do. He immediately gave me a $500 discount, which I thought was just fantastic.
That's beautiful.
Because I told him I was going to buy a piano. I wanted a little piano because I'm not very tall. So I wanted to be able to look over the piano to sit, to make eye contact with the residents. And then I decided I was going to also ask all my students. So instead of giving me Christmas presents, which is very kind of them, ask to give me money for this piano. And in this day and age, and these
are not old school GoFundMe.
And in this day and age, you know, already you can feel these are not super wealthy people. And of course, the super wealthy person wants to know exactly how much.
Right.
I was like, forget it. I was absolutely stunned by the level of generosity from these people, not only just from Vincitor's, John Vincitor, and that meant delivering the piano, taking the other one away, and all of those things.
Right.
But also the parents of my students, because I said, this is what I want to do. And then at the moment, I've got about approximately 10 10-year-olds. I've had them for years, and so they're all, so they come and now they now come and sing and play for the seniors,
right?
So they're getting this idea that music is about giving back. And not surprisingly, the families, the parents think giving back to the community is important. So therefore, that's part of their family values, and therefore they're very supportive of things that will encourage their children to think about others.
Right, right. The generosity, you're generous first, though, because you, instead of taking gifts from their parents, you're like, instead of giving me a gift, give me money and I'm going to buy it, and I'm going to give the piano to the facility.
I was very pleased about how well that has gone. It's a real little beacon of light to hang on to, and as you know, boy, do we need regular doses of wonderful things, like you mentioned in your story earlier, wonderful things of you've met this person and they've just got such a wonderful heart that you're sort of working out how can you work with them, how can you give back to them that you know they've touched you in a certain way, and you really appreciate the connection, and what can you do to help them, and that's what we need on a probably daily basis. I'm sure.
I wonder if music brings that out of people, though, because like this Lifted Project thing I do, that's insane generosity.
I think what has happened is that you've made it easy for people. And that's what I always find. I've seen this many over the years, that when you have good support, which could be good parents who think that music's important and there's not this fight and nonsense going on in the background, or if the kids young adults are living in a group home, if they have good helpers, mm-hmm. which, as we know, is very difficult because they don't get paid proper money at all.
Mm.
So what you see is that if you have good helpers, you can do good work.
Yes, yes.
So it's extraordinary. So I keep seeing that years and years and years that you see. So instead of me getting upset that I can't do the quality of the work I want to do, I can see that the reason I can't do that is because the situation does not permit it.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're doing a music program and there's this one at a nursing home and there's this wonderful piano, it's right next to the elevator. Double bind.
Yeah.
You can't do good work.
Mm-hmm.
How can you create a nice environment, especially in a nursing home?
When you hear ding every 4 seconds.
Precisely.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they were so proud of it, and they'd done a lot of, you know, home bakes and goodness knows what else to raise mm-hmm. the money to buy this piano. And they put it in a place that I thought was just ridiculous.
Do you do music therapy?
I have a music therapy degree.
Okay.
And what I do, because I looked at what you needed to do to get the certification, so I did all the degree work, and then I looked at the certification and all the hoops and all of that stuff and the 6-month internship, and I was like, yeah, and who's going to pay my rent while I do this? I was like, forget it. So to be respectful to all the music therapists who do all of that stuff, and then every year they have to recertify, or every 2 years.
Right.
You know, I'm very clear. I do not ever call myself a music therapist. I have a music therapy degree from SUNY New Paltz, which has a very fine reputation.
What made you choose music therapy even for your academics?
There were two options, one of which was that even though I have a master's from Manhattan School of Music, I am not considered qualified to teach music in the school system.
Why not?
Rules.
Which school system? I know music teachers who don't have their master's.
No, you have to have, you have to be certified by the state in how to teach music in a school.
Oh, okay.
Another rules and regulations.
Right.
So I thought that that was not very fair.
Mm-hmm.
So the options were, do I want to go back to school and do things to teach music to be eligible to get a job teaching music in a school system, or get a music therapy degree? And because I've always been interested in the therapeutic aspects of music, I went for the music therapy degree, which was more kind of aligned with my personal interests of using music to help others.
So almost everybody I have in here who has even academically pursued therapy has their own trauma that gets them started. What's yours?
I don't remember, because I'm the youngest in my family.
Okay.
So, and in those days in England, we didn't even have a TV. You know, a lot of people were poor. You know, England was until the 60s when certain people became very wealthy. People were just struggling with getting over the Second World War.
Mm.
Rationing didn't end until I think it was 1955. I looked it up the other day. So everybody was poor.
Mm.
So you were all struggling. So you didn't have, it was no big deal. No, I didn't know anybody who had a TV.
Right.
You know, we didn't have a telephone. You didn't have any of that stuff.
Right.
We did have a piano.
Mm.
And that's the whole thing.
There it is.
That what became a sign of perhaps middle class wealth in like 1890 was that you could afford to have a piano.
Right.
And then having a piano in your house obviously became a status symbol.
Mm-hmm.
And then bit by bit, more people were able to have a piano in the house. And so we were given a piano.
Mm.
And then my elder siblings had piano lessons, and the school that I was at had a music teacher we all thought was just absolutely the tops.
Mm.
And then she did something, which was she ran an after-school little music program. And playing records. You remember those?
Yep.
And because we didn't have a record player either.
Mm.
And I remember listening to her, I think, playing Beethoven symphonies, and I was stunned.
Mm.
I must have been like 7 or 8. So here you are, you have this wonderful music teacher. You know, your family has a piano, and you have music in your background. You have people making music.
Mm.
We didn't have a radio. So people were making music.
I love musician stories of when they first got turned on to music. Yours was Beethoven, and you were like...
So I was already doing music. I was playing recorders because my siblings played recorders. And then I think when I was 11, the one of the ladies... And you can imagine the story that she probably was teaching piano in the front room of her little house. And
yeah.
I think she genuinely probably was 80 at the time.
Mm.
You know, so she'd managed probably to survive the First and Second World War,
wow.
You know, and is just teaching piano lessons to just get by.
Yeah, and put a little good back in
so,
birth.
So I was able to, and she charged absolutely peanuts. So I was able to have piano lessons.
Mm.
Very inexpensively, because my parents didn't have any money,
right.
Much money. If they didn't have so many children, they would have had better money, but they didn't.
Children do chew up money.
Yes. I know you've only got one.
Right?
Yeah.
And she chews up money.
Yeah. So you get introduced to this whole world that seems totally miraculous because it's not your daily... You know what? You don't know because you're a kid, but later you realize it's a bit of a grind. Because you don't have all of these other things,
right.
But you do have music. And then you're at school where there's this fabulous music teacher and you're absolutely thrilled to bits to be able to play an F sharp on the descant recorder because that means you can get into another group.
Right, right.
Yeah, it is.
Mine was, I was going to a Catholic nursery school.
Yeah.
And Catholic kindergarten. And I'm not Catholic, but it was a private school. So my parents sent me there. And I'm 4 or 5 years old, and I even remember her name. Sister Mary Ellen walks in with a guitar,
mm-hmm.
and she sings from "You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown." Happiness is two kinds of ice cream. Da, da, da. And I remember watching her going, "What the fuck is that?" I was blown. I couldn't. And that was my Beethoven moment. I'm like, I gotta do that.
Yeah,
People shouldn't be able to make that. That's really cool.
Oh, it's extraordinary because it really does open up your world.
Yeah.
And to state the obvious things, it's not illegal. There's nothing negative involved in making music.
Until you start censoring your lyrics. Then you got a problem.
And then...
Do you write?
No, I don't.
You ever tried?
No, it doesn't interest me. What interests me is... I'm a teacher. It interests me working with people and helping to unlock their musicality.
Does everybody have musicality?
Yes, everyone is musical.
Meaning everybody can appreciate music or everybody can play music?
To play music is training in a certain way. Everybody is musical. The evolutionary purpose of singing is to soothe the child.
Mm, okay, that makes
we
sense.
We are hardwired...
To appreciate it.
To make music.
Oh, to make music.
So music, you know, and obviously every guy has a mother. You know, so this is the point of music is to soothe the child. It's the singing. It's that ooh.
It's the vibration.
And the rocking.
Yeah.
It's the lilting. That is what soothes the child.
Mm.
Then if there's music in the environment, i.e. if people think music, making music is important, not passively listening, making music,
right.
Which is what you see, you know, historically, you see all of these incredible families who live halfway up in the mountains in the middle of nowhere, Appalachia for starters, you know, and they've got less than nothing and they sing. But they don't know that they're singing. They're just thinking they're sort of calling down to, you know, so-and-so who's like, you know, half a mile down the mountain.
Right.
And they think they're just talking to them, but it's a sort of singing thing. It's just extraordinary.
Now I feel guilty.
So what you're dealing with is that's the natural impulse.
Mm.
And if there is a purpose for it to be used more often, i.e. you're stuck up the mountain and everybody does it, And then, you know, when you actually have a day off or 2 hours off, you get together and everybody sings and they do clog dance. It's just amazing. Mm. So that whole tradition is nurturing your music. And then because dad plays the guitar or banjo, you know, then you as a kid learn how to do that or the fiddle. You know, so you've got the family environment and the cultural environment, even if it's poor, that thinks music is important. And then all of that just gets continued to pass down the generations and hopefully continues to live and grow. Unfortunately, because of the radio and sheet music and making music individually began to get over to people who were very good at it, you know, who then justifiably became very famous. And it's extraordinary when you start look, because I like history, obviously. You start seeing the background, like
so.
Do you feel
that when music became like a commodity, it dissuaded people from enjoying it because I can't play like so and so?
And it's just got worse. Because,
that's an interesting thought.
Because the technology is so remarkable and has been for like 50, 60 years. I remember years ago when I was at the Royal Academy of Music, I worked Friday evenings as the backstage usher at Wigmore Hall, which was a lovely little, it still is there. It's a beautiful hall where if you're making your debut, you'd rent that hall or you'd win a competition. You go make your Wigmore Hall debut. It's got like 500 seats. Beautiful little place. And so I had to page turn and I had to move the Steinway piano around and had to do various things at the whim of some of these very, very famous people. And so I just ended up hearing a lot of music. Like there was, I remember being electrified by, I'm sure I'm not pronouncing his name properly, Paco Peña. Jaw was on the floor. Like I didn't, you know, flamenco guitar, as you know.
Yeah.
I was just like, whoa, you know, and then one. So yes, I was getting a little bit of money. But then I was watching all of these incredible people, some people who were just remarkably famous. And you just see them backstage and on stage, which was very amusing, the difference. often the difference between some of these real characters. And then you got other people like Julian Bream, a very famous guitarist, lute player as well. Very quiet, just very quiet. And he's got all these... what are they, 12-string lutes or something? You know, it's like going out there, just very quiet backstage and very... And then you get other people who are just very big personalities and you see the big difference and you're just like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
So I was just involved in a lot of listening to music. And then because I got very good at page turning, I ended up being hired to page turn for recordings. And then you start seeing, oh, here we are. We're on doing the Trout Quintet, and which has a brutal piano part. And we're on now 350th take of two measures. And you go into the recording booth and you see the recording engineer like, you know.
Yep.
Oh, okay. And you just like, oh, you start seeing the artificiality that has come into the music because of the recording situation.
Yeah. Well, and now you don't even do 350 takes. Now you do two and they fix it.
Oh, precisely. Yeah. And all of the stuff. So you see it's become more and more perfect in a way, which is very off-putting.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, there's one thing. Look, whether or not you like Frank Sinatra, you know, that guy could really sing.
Oof.
And
I love Sinatra, by the way.
What I can understand that if you heard Sinatra sing certain songs, then you'd like to sing them. How can you ever sing a song that Sinatra has sung and sing it in a way that is appropriate for you, not trying to do, you know, an impersonation of Sinatra?
You will love this story.
So that's a bit of a challenge. But if you love music enough, you will continue to work with the songs. But people have just, over the years, got put off by people who are very good, and justifiably so, but because of that.
I used to do this evening with James Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
I would cover James Taylor for 2.5 hours.
Yeah.
And I have a theory about James Taylor as a guitarist. Yeah. And so, but I did it for like 15, 20 years.
Yeah.
And I wound up sounding exactly like James Taylor.
Yes.
Not good, because that's not me. No, that's James Taylor. Precisely. My voice isn't like that at all.
Yes.
So one day I had a vocal coach in here named Cher. And she's a teacher like you. And I said, okay, sum up what I'm doing wrong with my voice in one sentence. And she's like, sing like you talk.
Yes.
Oh, okay, right.
Totally. I say this to some of the kids who've it's very interesting when you see in a little 8-year-old and they start singing and you're just like, who are they pretending to be?
Yeah.
But that concept's a bit complicated for 8-year-olds.
Right. For 60-year-olds, I got it.
But that's the whole thing, is that my job is to help you contact you and bring that forward, which for some people can take a lot of digging. So it's partly educational. So the kids come in with certain sounds that they like. My job is to amplify that, to get them to listen to different things.
Right.
And because the world of music's huge. So you want that to be open, not just like, oh, there's only three things I like.
When I used to teach guitar.
Yeah.
I used to say, I'm not going to teach you how to play the guitar. Pick three songs that you like.
Yeah.
I'm going to teach you how to play those three songs. Then you're going to fall in love because you can play three songs on a guitar. And now you're going to want to learn the instrument and go everywhere else.
Precisely.
And that's the same thing that you're saying, right?
Yeah. What I always do is start with singing, because singing is the natural phenomenon.
Mm.
There's no technicality in basic singing. Anyone can sing Home on the Range.
Right.
Unless,
I know a guy who can't.
Unless they've been hugely traumatized. And that's what I often find is.
Interesting.
So here's a great story. This is a mom. I think her son is being encouraged by the music program to pick an instrument for band. Fine. Now she wants him to have exposure to some other instruments. So in those days, I had a whole bunch of brass instruments. I can do basic brass instruments. So the kiddo can come in and blow things, and then I can see how well they blow, how big are their fingers, how big are they.
Mm.
And it's terrible. So the kid turned up, lovely kid. We had a ball. And so he's playing, I taught him Owen the Saints, Dead Easy. So I'm doing chords on the piano and he's playing it, the tune. Then his mum comes to pick him up. And I said, oh, just coming in, we're just singing Other Saints. I said, oh, why don't you join in? She said, oh, I can't sing. She said, and she showed me her hands that were shaking, because she said her best friend's mother told her when she was 16 she had an ugly voice.
Mm.
And so here she is being a good mom in terms of having the kid listen to engage with different material, but doesn't want to get that trauma out of herself.
Right.
And honestly, her hands were shaking.
Oh.
Just at the thought of singing Owen the Saints in a very informal environment. And those, I have hundreds of those stories.
Tell me what you think of this theory. So I think it is hubris for us to say that we have a word for every feeling we have. And even the words that we have for our feelings aren't good, because feelings are on a spectrum. So I could be mad.
Terrible.
Yeah. I could be mad at traffic or mad at my daughter. Those are two completely different.
Yeah. And also, what is your definition of mad?
Right. Right. And then what is that? I think why one of the ways that music heals is it lets you, when you're listening to it, it articulates feelings that there aren't words for.
Yes.
At precisely where they are on the spectrum, on where you are, on what that feeling is for you.
It's nonverbal.
Yeah, but it's nonverbal and it's pinpoint accurate. Like I'll play a major seventh chord to you, and it'll be pinpoint accurate for what you draw out of it. I may draw something different out of it, but it never misses. It draws out of you exactly what
you respond to it.
Yeah,
absolutely, and that response is something, I think this is where I go off into gardening, you know, needs to be encouraged, because it's the response that's important, and that can grow and develop. And then you have somebody who's got something for the rest of their life.
Yeah.
And you cannot put a price on that. It's just extraordinary. And that brings us into all the stories of people who, you know, they have a day job, which is pretty cruddy, but does pay the rent. And they've taken up the classical guitar because they've always wanted to. And now it keeps them sane. They manage to do their day job. They keep their marriage in good shape. And they play the guitar for 2 hours a day.
Are you describing me?
No. You don't play classical guitar.
I don't. But I had a guy in here. I'm playing with him on Sunday.
Yeah.
Do you know Dan Stevens?
No, but I know how, having looked how complicated classical guitar music is. It's terrifying. You look at the wall. You look at those darts, and you go like, and I read music pretty well.
Right.
And you just look at that like, oh my God, they have to make all these unbelievable.
No, I'm watching them. I'm trying to do. I think I broke my hand.
Yeah,
I'm watching
I can understand that. Yeah,
it's not. But the thing that you don't like electric guitar.
No, it's not my thing because I like acoustic.
Yes.
I like people. I like the humanity. That interests me. So anything...
Electric piano?
Anything electronic takes you away from that because it's not you making the changes in how you play that affect the other person. That is the most powerful.
And it's not the relationship between you and the instrument either. It's the relationship between the instrument and the amp.
So, anything to do with electronics,
we're the same. I don't play anything electronic either. I know people who do, but I don't do it.
The thing is, I'm in certain situations. Like I've got, I've been hired to do a music program with a couple of kids who are officially disabled. Their music skills are off the spectrum. But because of the other stuff, you know, who knows what the rest of their lives are going to be? Are they just going to live in a group home? And again, because I didn't want to be tyrannized by the lack of equipment, I actually went out and bought myself a small keyboard because the most important thing is getting these kids, because I have a very luxurious gig with them because they're fabulous. Mm. I just have the two of them. So we're doing all of this stuff together, and they do all of these incredibly complicated stuff.
Really?
Oh God, yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Would you allow them to perform?
I put in a request. I'm very pleased that one of them who's done really well now no longer needs an aid in my class.
Oh wow!
I've sent
you what music does.
I've sent in a request saying, is it possible that this person can be invited to come to my music program at the assisted living facility at the Fountains?
Mm.
Because music is their thing. And I don't know the upper, you know, who is it? Is it the parents? And of course, there's a very ugly divorce. And so, you know, who knows? But all I know is that this is one of their gifts. And if they were allowed to come and sing with the seniors every week for half an hour, it would help everybody.
Yep.
Because the seniors there, one of their favorite songs is "How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?" It's like, for goodness sake.
I can pull that off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we're not talking.
Right.
And they don't care because in a certain way, they've probably forgotten what you did last week. So don't get bent out of shape about it. They're happy to sing Edelweiss every single time.
Yeah,
there's an incredible variety of just fabulous music. So here I have this opportunity. I sent the email. Their classroom teacher is brilliant. So hopefully they get it.
Okay,
because they think music's important.
Right.
But who knows at the upper, you know, the parental level.
That would be a cool lifted project.
So that's what it's an intergenerational program, and that's what I've been involved with years. For years is doing music with people with disabilities. I used to have a big program taking them to assisted facilities. But it was, you're always at the mercy of the administration.
Yeah.
You know, it's very hard. This might be an easier gig because it's nearby. It's 10 minutes from the house.
Okay.
You know, it's just half an hour. It's not.
Right.
I understand the logistics. If you have a group home, you may have 8 people living in the group home. And then how many staff to look after these 8 people?
Right.
Let alone the shifts and... and the staggering underfunding of all of these group homes.
I'm going to introduce you to somebody.
So And then you can, so I've done this stuff for years and years and years and years. So I know how to deal with all of this stuff. Mm. I'm hoping this will go, because it's just one person. I'll be playing the piano. They know me. So right. We'll see. Fingers crossed on that. But it's really interesting, because if you make an assumption, I don't know about you, John. I've been putting a lot of energy in the last 15 years not to make assumptions. Because anytime I make an assumption, I always get myself in a mess. Even if it's a relatively silly one, like, oh, Tuesday at 10 o'clock's fine. Then I go and look in the calendar and I was like, no, that was a mistake. I made an assumption, you know.
Right.
So, you know, with the kids, it's always looking how can I help them move forward? How can I help all of these bits that they have, which are not integrated, become more integrated? How can I help them realize that what they're feeling, is that back to your word thing, is that feeling that they're experiencing, are they cross? What's the difference for them for being cross as opposed to angry? Right. Because obviously I'm English, which is why I sound funny. So, so you have the different language usage in America than England. So what cross might mean to me is different to a 9-year-old kid.
Right.
So the important thing is to help them be comfortable with that label is accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And what is it precisely they are cross about?
Mm.
So it's always kind of being a detective and looking for stuff and helping it unfold, and then in certain places getting certain things to be integrated. So if you can sing notes, you can find them on the piano,
because
you can just sing a note and then you can just see if you can find it. How quickly can you find that note that you just sang on the piano? So you get your fingers connected to your singing.
Do you practice?
No.
Not at all?
No, I play music. I look for music for my students. So that means I go through music books to see, would Jimmy like this?
Right.
And how about this? And then when the really lovely thing is, the parent of one of my students found a Beatles book that was arranged for piano for simple. And it was a really good arrangement. Like, to arrange music is really hard.
Yes, ma'am.
And so this was a great book, and I was absolutely thrilled to bits, because Dad is a great Beatles fan. So the kid is now learning these Beatles songs because her dad's a great Beatles fan. And I bought this book, and I thought it was so fantastic because it's got all the words and all my kids sing. Everybody sings that I work with.
Mm.
And now I've got 3 or 4 other students who are doing the Beatles book. And so that meant I've had to play all the songs to get some familiarity with it, to understand, oh, well, that bit might be a bit tricky.
Mm-hmm.
So I keep going through music. So yes, I play.
But you're not practicing specific things. You're just...
No. And then if something really engages me, I will still have like, oh, I wonder if so-and-so would like to play this. So, and if it's a more complicated piece of music, then I have to put a bit of time and energy into being able to play it a little bit to say to them, I thought you might like this, and be able to play it.
Do you like musical theater?
Oh, I love musical theater. So I've got all these kids singing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning, Edelweiss, Doe a Deer. Or, you know, all the 6-year-olds play Doe a Deer on the piano, one hand.
Mm.
And they all, because they all sing. Nice. Because I look for words, I look for songs that have positive words and have good melodies.
Mm.
So it means I sort of stop about, except for The Sound of Music, I stop about 1935.
Okay.
Yeah, because the lyrics a lot of the lyrics can be really inappropriate. So I'm not teaching 8-year-olds stuff like this.
Right.
And that's why they all do I'm Forever Blowing Bubbles, Let Me Call You Sweetheart, I Love You Truly, because all those parlor songs.
Right.
Of 1890, 1900, 1900, were written to be sung by people who aren't highly trained. It's making music around the piano of an evening.
Mm.
And then all... and then the powerful thing with the music program that I run is a lot of these songs are in 3-4, and 3-4 has that lilt to it.
Yep. It'll mesh up on the guitar, but yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah. And it's much more soothing.
Yeah.
It's more, so you can sort of get away with 6/8 as well because it's got that same 1, 2, 3, 4, yeah. And it's that lilt. Mm. And they all, it's not only the seniors are a bit more fragile, they can't hear all the words to fast songs. And interestingly, they all know these songs. So it means they have, and they're not that old. So the seniors are, what, 80s, 90s? And these songs were written in 1892. They all know them.
Mm.
So that means their families sang them. So they are singing Let Me Call You Sweetheart. And it evokes that memory
right.
of their family.
Right.
It's incredible. Like, I think this was a few years ago. There's a song, I'll Be Down to Get You in a Taxi, Honey. You Better Be Ready by 8:30. It's Docktown Strutters Ball. It's written in 1900. And this lady was saying that she always wanted to sing this song. She always wanted me to sing this song because she was getting ready to go to church on a Sunday morning. And that's what her mother would sing with her while she's putting on her Sunday best to go. So these are just incredible things that get said to you. They're powerful memory.
Yeah.
So for her, she just loved singing that song, and so every time I was there, she always wanted, you know, you ask people, do they remember songs? And of course they don't, and they're embarrassed because they've forgotten. So then I play a game of I just play the first three notes of a tune, and they all remember what it is. To get them active, it's active music making is the powerful thing. Not listening to someone who's a super whizzy person.
Right.
Not that one lady there was saying, this was a great story because it was Frank Sinatra. She used to teach English at I think, Westchester Community College. And so she went down, she was able to see Frank Sinatra. She said it was one of those iconic moments in her life because he had that capacity, among others, that when he looked at you, you felt you were the only person in the world.
Mm.
And here she is dealing with all of these incredible health issues and goodness knows what else, and sharing that memory. And you're just like, whoa.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you remember, quick Sinatra story.
Yeah.
Do you remember the weekend that Sinead O'Connor tore the picture of the Pope up on Saturday Night Live?
No, but I know about it.
Okay. So
the night before,
it used to be called the Garden State Arts Center in New Jersey.
She
performed there. And the tradition there is that whoever the headliner is, before even the opener, comes out and sings the national anthem. That's just a tradition there.
Was Sean O'Connor? Forget it.
She wouldn't do it.
Of course not.
So that's a Friday night. On Saturday night, she tears up a picture of the Pope on Saturday Night Live.
Ooh.
On Sunday afternoon, I go see Sinatra at the Garden State Arts Center.
Yeah.
And it's 2:00 in the afternoon, and he comes out. He's already got the drink. Because he was older then.
Yeah.
But still, he destroys the national anthem. He can sing anything. He crushes the national anthem. Everybody goes nuts. It dies down, and he goes to the microphone. He goes, if she wasn't abroad, I'd punch her in the nose. That's classic Sinatra.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Or that, you know, the one about him and the sands?
I know the casino, yeah.
So the Rat Pack they're going to sign. Yeah, they're going to sign the biggest entertainment contract in history. They're doing a residency at the Sands, right?
Yeah.
So they get there a day of, and they're reading through the contract, and all of a sudden Sinatra says, whoa, he goes, there's no Sammy Davis in
here. I know. He was incredibly supportive.
Yeah. And so he said in the meeting, Davis, no Sinatra.
And walked absolutely.
Out. That's pretty stand-up.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty stand-up.
No, there's extraordinary stuff like that. So I think that my interest is always community. My interest is helping kids love of music be grow and develop so that they have something that for the rest of their lives, because I don't know what they're going to do or be, you know.
Right. The economics of what you do, the economics of the music business in general, but the economics of what you do, you perform at a nursing home, right? Or you provide music,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, I do a sing-along, what they
do
call
sing-along.
Yeah.
Okay. Definitely the high point of the day for the people that are in there with you.
Yeah.
Right? They've played cards, they've eaten the pudding, they've done everything. You're the only different thing.
Yeah.
And music lifts you.
Yeah.
So you're the only thing, high point of their day. They're in a facility that charges $10,000 a month.
Or whatever.
15, 12, whatever it is.
They all overcharge.
Yeah. And we won't say what you're making, but I could.
Oh, it's coffee money.
I could get, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
No, it's coffee money. And all the staff, it's the same sort of thing. The fat cats are getting fatter and everyone else is getting thinner.
Is there a fix for this for music? Is there a way to fix this? Because you're providing the highest point paying a facility $15,000 to give seniors the highest point. You're giving it to them and you're getting...
Because as we know, the people in authority who have usually power and money usually do not think that music's important. There's other things that they do.
But it isn't just what you do. It playing out. Like you play out and bring people to a restaurant and blah, 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 blah. And you get a little bit more in coffee money, but not much more.
I tell you, the high point of getting gas at this place was me figuring out how to switch the TV off. Because I was so irritated with this noise. I pressed every single button and I found out which one that mutes it. Because you have constant background music, which means that you don't hear music. You are inundated with it.
Right.
And then everyone...
You're desensitized to it.
Thank you. That's a much better word. And then you have these multi-installation, whatever they are, with flashing lights and the whole god. So then you are even more out of touch with anything profound that's being provided. Everything's mic'd. Everything is artificial. So you don't even know what music is anymore because you haven't even made music that's not acoustic. When was the last time anyone listened to a record, let alone a 78?
Right.
Oh, well, the sound isn't very good, you know. Oh, can you hear it? Oh, so-and-so, they're out of tune. Yeah, it's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. That's irrelevant.
Just come on. Are you cold?
No, I'm okay. The air conditioning did come on.
Oh, okay. But you're comfortable?
No, I'm fine.
Okay.
Not if I stay here too long, but... So it's become a product which is all about making the gap between people and people bigger and bigger.
This is my prediction. Tell me what you think. I think acoustic music makes a gigantic comeback because we become, you can't change the animal. The human animal needs connection, right? And as you say, we're so disconnected to music right now because it's in digital
form. It's a product.
In digital form, it's just too easy to get, and it's everywhere. And you, like you said, you become desensitized to it.
Totally.
I think that reaches a critical mass, and I think people go back to wait a second. It is more fun to listen to Dad do James Taylor. With, you know, my family and the teenagers that are sleeping over, than it is to crank a playlist on Spotify.
I really hope that's true because then that would be people being actually having a spark of sensitivity in themselves, i.e., they hasn't been beaten out of them or dulled out of them.
Yeah,
you know, because people use all sorts of things to dull themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't want to feel anything.
What do you listen to when you're
so,
home?
I make music.
So you don't listen?
I don't like passive listening. What I will listen to, because I'm always interested in the kiddos' music, even though some of it is like way beyond horrific as far as I'm concerned. But I'll ask them what do they listen to? So then I do my homework and I have to listen to them. Or one of the seniors, she wanted to know, did I know Cruising Down the River on a Sunday afternoon? Never heard it. So, you know, I know it's digital, it's YouTube and everything. So I was listening to that. I was like, oh, that's a really nice song. You know, and it's one of her favorite songs.
Right.
Even though she'll have forgotten about it, every time I say, oh, this especially, you know, Lisa wants this song.
Right.
So
have you ever had a student who you thought should go pro, who just was so had such a gift that you're like, listen, this could be a career for you?
Yes, I have. But they went to circus school, which I thought was much a better idea.
Circus school?
Yes.
Wow.
Because their parents were extraordinary.
Mm.
So the kid thought it was a waste of time going to university, went to circus school.
Mm.
And was suitably cross brilliant at that too.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. That's kind of cool.
I would never recommend anyone go into music as a profession because it will kill their love of music.
Didn't yours, huh?
No, because I was able to get into doing more teaching, so I didn't have to.
Oh, you mean performing music?
As yeah. A,
yeah.
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 Get a day job or be in a situation where you can do something that doesn't really, it's not super complex, and then you can keep the complexity of your humanity and to enrich your music making. That's where I go with that.
Right.
Yeah.
Can you sum up Alexander Technique for me? I have been fascinated by it. Don't know what it is. I shouldn't say fascinated. I've been curious about it.
Well, Alexander's work. The one sentence, what you're dealing with, it's a hands-on educational method for changing patterns that cause tension, stress and tension. It's not a great definition because you're dealing with kinesthetic information. But what you're dealing with is that here's Alexander losing the use of his voice on stage in 1890.
Oh, I didn't know that. Wow.
And because he only lost his voice on stage.
Oh, that's awkward.
Writing, I think it was in the 1890s, but he thought about it because the doctors gave him a diagnosis of clergyman's throat and the idea was that you rested. Mm. Well, that didn't work. So he began a process of figuring out, well, why do I only lose my voice on stage?
When I need it the most.
What am I doing? More importantly, what am I doing to myself to cause my voice loss on stage?
Okay.
And once you start answering that question, you come up with all the things that you are doing to stop your voice from working.
And we're talking physically doing.
You have an idea. Someone says, go out on the stage, grab hold of the stage. You are not a bird, but you go out and do that with your toes. That's going to muck up your breathing.
Mm.
It's going to make it very hard for your voice to function. You have a whole collection of things like that, which are ideas that we've been picked up along the way or people have taught.
Okay.
So the classic one is that when you breathe, your shoulders shouldn't move, which doesn't make any sense because you've got lung up here.
Right.
I think there's one thing to say, if the first thing that you do when you breathe is raise your shoulders, that's not so great. But shoulders moving should be the last thing if you're taking big amounts of oxygen.
Right.
And if you're not sure about it, just watch Maria Callas in one of those dresses that she wore in the 50s singing. Her shoulders move. And it's like that lady's some serious singer.
Right.
And serious actress. It's like, come on. So you get somebody saying or somebody interpreting. This was hilarious. I was doing some work, some Alexander work with somebody who is a singer, songwriter, performer. And
do I know them?
No.
Okay.
And if you, I have no idea, and I'm not telling you their name anyway. So they're telling me in all seriousness that their voice teacher girl told them to sing from here. And so they're doing this.
Mm.
Now, on a practical level, I wasn't in the lesson, so I don't know what the singing teacher said. I know what the girl demonstrated to me that she thought her singing teacher was telling her to do.
Okay.
Now, if somebody told me to sing from here, I think they'd be telling, I would interpret as, put my whole heart into it.
Right.
Be more authentic.
Mm-hmm.
Or if I didn't understand, hopefully I would say, I'm not sure what you mean. What do you mean when you say sing from here?
Right.
Now, this person had very, very, it was this. So they were singing.
Mm.
So the voice, that creates a lot of tension in your voice because you're fixing your ribs, let alone the other odd things that you're doing by sticking your chest out like that.
Do you teach breath work?
Because you're dealing with the breath.
Right.
So if you ever want to improve your breathing, don't worry about breathing into your belly, first of all.
Right.
There's no lungs down there. Second,
I've always thought that was weird. Yes, thank you.
Yeah. How many millions of people teach that?
Yeah, breathe under your diaphragm. And
well, you can't.
You can't. Right.
Now, the reality is, if your ribs move, your belly will move.
Right.
But because we're human and we're clever, we can fix the ribs and push the belly out. Because we're clever. So there's all of these all of these misconceptions about breathing, and then there's some serious fighting going on in the scientific community whether or not your diaphragm, if you can control your diaphragm,
right?
So it's split 50-50.
Mm.
But also, you know, and this is where people can go down lots of rabbit holes. But the thing is that if you dutifully do your meditation program, thinking of all my Alexander students, and only your belly is moving and your ribs are not moving, you are tightening your ribs because you are stopping them from moving.
Mm. What's the meditation program?
Oh, any meditation program.
They'll
all be sticking out their belly. And if they're lying down, they'll be putting books on their belly and pushing it out.
Mm. Did you ever...
And pranayams and, you know.
You ever hear of John Sarno?
Yes.
I saw him.
Yeah, because one of my students had that weird thing. He couldn't walk or something.
Yeah.
And he was quite young. He was like 27. And
same.
He did a gazillion things. And then finally did some work with John Sarno, who said it's all in your head.
Yeah, but...
Because my student, who I still work with, is really, really intellectually very smart. It's like, oh, and 6 months later he was walking.
And it's
even though you look at the pictures of the spine's a mess.
Well, mine was my hands. Yeah. But it goes to your breath story.
Yeah.
I couldn't use my hands anymore. They were cramping all the time like really couldn't hold like a pencil and anything. Yeah. And so I listened to Howard Stern. Howard Stern got his back fixed from John Sarno.
Yeah,
so
I'm like,
okay, I'm going to try it. So I go down. Had to give him $1,000 cash, which I thought was a little weird, but whatever. And he gives me a physical because I'd been to doctors and they're like, you have carpal tunnel syndrome. We're going to have to.
Which may be true, but surgery may not help.
So
it didn't help one of my students.
No. Yeah. So he says to me, he gives me the physical and he says, there's nothing wrong with your hands. And I'm like, well, why are they twitching? And he goes, you're angry. And when you're angry, you dysregulate your breathing. When you dysregulate your breathing, your muscles don't have enough oxygen and they cramp.
Precisely.
Yeah. And same with Alexander, right?
So wonderful story.
Yeah. So all you have to do, he goes, and you don't even have to believe me. Just pretend that is true.
Yes.
And just
fake it until you make it.
Yeah.
Make it until, yeah. That's
fake it until you make,
make it. Yeah.
By that night, I could handwrite. And the next day, I could play guitar again.
Yeah.
And it's all breath.
Yes.
All breath work.
But it's interesting because it's an idea.
Mm.
It's an idea that you have in your mind. Because at some level, you may have been conditioned that, first of all, not to know when you're angry. That's a good one.
Yep.
And then if you were angry, you will never, ever have a correct label for the feeling. The emotion that you're feeling is actually anger.
And if you're a guy and you express anger.
Forget it.
Right.
Yeah.
So then
20, 30 years of not knowing what is going on inside of yourself is going to create problems.
Screwed up my hands.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
It just happened to go that way. Now, if you were a dancer, it wouldn't have gone to your hands.
Right.
It would have gone to your feet.
Right, exactly. Or if I was a singer, it would have gone to my voice.
Throat.
Yeah, yeah,
If you're Alexander, it went to his voice because he was doing dramatic monologues.
Oh, okay. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
So there's the idea.
Do you do anything to your hands? Like any exercising? Any?
No, what I do have is a combination of, it was something somebody recommended. I can't remember the second. It's castor oil and, I don't know, is it poke root or something? And there's a cream that they make, and it's really great for joints.
Oh, wow.
And besides music, my second favorite thing is wielding the pickaxe and digging up the garden.
You're going to live forever, lady.
You will
never die.
And wheelbarrow, you know, so I come in and like, oh, I actually have five fingers on each hand. So I need to play to rehab. I've got digital, you know, mastery. And then I always put this cream. It's and also coincidentally, everything I use is organic. So I just find I put that on 2-3 times a day. It's fantastic.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think musicians age better than other people?
Oh, absolutely.
Why?
Because they have something that they deeply believe in.
Mm.
And it keeps them going.
Yeah.
It keeps them going, you know. And
that makes sense.
There's tons and tons of science about all of that. And there's going to be some other things, like musicians are going to be curious.
Mm-hmm.
They'll be interested in listening to something else, or they'll, you know, you could, depending on what type of music they're interested in. Like,
and there's less repressed feeling in musicians.
So I'm not a great fan of folk music, but I really like bluegrass for whatever reason. I have no idea why. Okay. And then several years ago, there was some little, because I like documentaries, I saw a little documentary on the dancing that goes with the bluegrass. I was like, oh, that makes sense.
Mm.
So there was something, you know, in all of these incredibly, these dancers, and there, some of them were like 95, and they, you know, can imagine that they were so deprived as children, probably
right.
Didn't. Probably, it's amazing they're alive. They probably just drank blue ruin, you know, moonshine for most of their life because they just didn't have any food.
Right.
And you saw the dancing. It was like, oh, now it makes sense.
Because
I just love the banjo, but this constant, constant sound. It's like, no, you can't breathe. You need some, where's the singing? But when I saw the dancing, it was amazing. Mm.
So I'm doing this guitar series.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And I'm classical.
Yeah.
First one's classical. And I'm looking, I can kind of do it. I had him in here and I'm like, I can kind of keep up. I can keep up with him. So then I'm having people from different genres, yeah. Right? So the Bluegrass Society tells me to hire this guy.
Yeah.
So I do. And yeah. I look and play. I'm like, I can't get anywhere close to that. That's just,
it's amazing. It's amazing.
It's way harder than anything Eddie Van Halen ever did. Yeah. Way harder.
It's just extraordinary.
Yeah.
So, because I've always liked history. And then if you have the context, the context is so important. So somebody I'm doing music with, he's nonverbal. He's been living in a group home forever and a day. He's probably in his 60s. He turns up and I'm trying to do music with him. And I'm like, what is wrong with him? Oh, his aide forgot to tell me that his roommate of 35 years died.
Hmm.
Oh, thank you. You've made an assumption that because this person's nonverbal and God knows what else, that would not have had an effect on him.
Right.
And therefore, you didn't think it was important to share it to me.
Yeah.
Because my little music session with him would have gone totally differently if I had known that this was in the background.
Yeah.
So whether it's dancing that makes bluegrass make sense to me, and it's very nice to see also, you know, the grandson is now,
yeah,
you know, the grandson who's like 40 is doing stuff, and it's long may it live.
Do you dance?
I've just started taking tap dancing. I'm so pleased that there's two places near where I am. They've actually managed to get enough people to run an adult beginners dance club. Tap class.
Mm.
So, because I love tap. You know,
how long have you been doing it?
3 weeks.
Oh, okay.
So swing.
Are you bad at it still?
No.
Oh, really?
No.
You picked it up right away?
Oh, you can. If you're a musician, you're an Alexander teacher, you're good with your body. And so so moving is not a problem. It's just training your foot to do this, that, and the other stuff.
Oh, okay.
It's terribly easy. And you know, it's not just I've watched, you know, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers a gazillion times, and I love all of that.
Right.
That the music from the 20s and 30s is some of my favorite music.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you think you'll ever retire?
No, I don't believe in the concept.
I don't either. Thank you very much.
I think what I would like to do is to have some more adult students. So what I've been doing, so this is a good story. So I'm calling it, what I'm doing is kind of personal development through music, because I want to get some more adults, for many reasons. So here's the story. So I'm the third piano teacher for somebody, very, very, very lovely person. And they've got problems with their left shoulder to some degree. Yeah, they do a lot of driving, was what I think it was a lot is driving, you know, like 12 hours a week, you know, commuting and stuff. Also, you're in the commuting zone, so that means there's a million cars driving like idiots on the road, which, right. so your commute is even more stressful. And I'm just looking at how they're moving. Their left arm is moving on the piano, and I can see it's just not moving very well.
Mm.
So I have a conversation with them about it, because they have grandma's piano, and grandma's piano is a 52-inch upright, and it's a beautiful piece of furniture, and it was designed to be a big, loud piano. This piano does not play quietly. This is sort of in the parlor when everyone's dancing, you know, it's right. amazing. So this is not some, you know, rinky-dink piano. This is a serious piano. 52-inch upright means it's got long strings, which means it has a better sound. That's why grand pianos are even better, because you can have longer strings. Mm. It's just that simple. So we have a bit of a chat about some of the difficulties. They come back with, they feel they can't move their left arm freely because they and their spouse have a little wine cooler, and the wine cooler is on the other side of the piano. Now, if you think about it on a practical level, it's utter rubbish, because the piano is...
How much wine are you drinking that it's packed on your shoulder?
No, it's a psychological thing that they don't feel they can move, even though...
I see.
They are on a full-size piano.
It's in the space.
So it's in... And they have a very small little house. And so it's in the space between the other side of the piano and the wall.
I got it. I thought he was hurting reaching
for
it.
No. And then what happened? For them, it was like the light bulb went off, because they said that. Because they realized that their interpretation is stopping their left hand from moving easily.
Mm.
They had that realization. They moved the wine cooler. It's a little one. Their piano playing's got better.
That's amazing.
Because they had the idea. They were interested in talking with me about the idea that was holding them back.
Right.
Which was nothing to do with hours of practice or any of that crap. It was to do with an idea.
That makes sense.
So now their shoulder doesn't hurt.
Right. That makes sense.
I'm not knocking the physiotherapy and other things that they've done have not helped.
Right.
But their piano playing got better.
Yeah, piano playing starts in your head. You know.
It's the idea. So what I'm interested in doing more is working with adults who want to develop themselves through music, because it's your ideas. So if you have an idea that you can't make music because you don't read, you have to get that idea out of your head.
And meet Paul McCartney, who can't read music.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if that's strictly true.
Hold on. Hey, Siri, can Paul McCartney read music?
I know John couldn't, because I...
Now playing this is Paul McCartney on Spotify.
No.
No, never mind.
No, because I...
Sorry about that. Hold on.
John Lennon could not read music.
Okay, well then, forget Paul McCartney.
I think Paul can. And I know...
Michael Jackson can't. Couldn't.
But the whole
you're not a Michael Jackson fan,
not particularly. But I do know a lot about the background to the Beatles and their wonderful manager, and who got sent to the Guildhall School of Music.
Mm.
Yeah, very so. Yeah, St. George. There's a wonderful documentary about his work with the Beatles.
Cool.
It's fabulous. So the thing is, but if you have an idea that you can't do music because you can't read music, then we have the until we can't go very far until we get that idea out of your head.
Right.
So I have to show you that is not important. Reading music can be helpful because it opens up the world of music.
Right.
Absolutely.
Do you find when you do that with people, when you give somebody a small, I'm all about the small wins, and a small win in music is huge, because problem solving comes in steps, right? Any problem solving comes in steps.
Oh, yeah.
And all you need is like that first small win on a piano to and then you have the sentence in your head, well, wait a minute, if I can do that,
absolutely.
I can do this. You just need that first small music win.
What I find all the time is even 5-year-olds can tell if Mary Had a Little Lamb didn't sound right.
Right.
And I've been told off on various occasions by various 5-year-olds. Because my last line is a little different than the one that is often used over here. But the thing is, they all know if it doesn't sound right. They just do not have the language skills to be able to explain it to themselves why it doesn't sound right, let alone being able to fix it, which is why doesn't it sound right? What is it? Did you play a wrong note? Are you playing, or there's all sorts of things. So that all the time, all my teaching is enhancing that, saying to them, I said, especially with the younger kid, if you said it was 10 out of, we're going to play a silly game. If it was 10 out of 10, it was super brilliant. So we agree it's not super brilliant. What rating would you give it? So they start to self-assess. And it's interesting because if I thought it was an 8 and they thought it was an 8, then we're on the same page. If I thought it was a 7 and they thought it was a 4, that's indicative of how bad they feel about themselves.
Mm.
So that's another thing that I play with the young kids.
That's kind of cool.
The older kids can do it a bit better because they have more thinking, so they can analyze.
But
so,
you can become aware of your low self-esteem that way too. That's an actual illustration of it. No, I'm an experienced music teacher. I'm telling you, you're 7. If you think you're a 4, you got to work on that gap.
They won't get it. Depending on the age, they won't understand that. I don't say Dickie Bird on that one. I keep that to myself.
Can I use Dickie Birds? That's a great phrase.
Not in America, because you'll get into trouble. You can in England.
I may try it anyway.
No, I know. That's fine.
That's actually the name of my band. I'm going to start a band called Dickie Birds.
Part of it, what I'm doing is always listening, assessing, looking, noticing. Right. And then using that information, so with the younger kids, get them to dance. I play something and I see how they dance. I play a different piece of music and see if they dance differently.
Mm.
That tells me how they feel.
Right.
There's all sorts of things that you can get them to do.
For the adults, what are you looking for? Are you looking for people that play already or just want to feel held back? Or are you looking for somebody that thinks maybe I could grow as a person if I just learned a little music?
All of those. They've actually relocated. Their family's relocated from Missouri to New York because their 3 kids are at colleges, nearby. So it's less drive.
Right.
So they're in New York because then it's 3 hours to this one, 2 hours to that one, and 4 hours to that one.
Wow.
Instead of 12.
Right, right.
So they can spend more time with their kids.
Mm.
Because they think their kids are important.
Right.
Which is great.
Yes.
And the dad is now having piano lessons. They had piano lessons 40 years ago, and they've just never had the time, very good dad, very good job, being able to have mom stay home, look after the kids. And, they do all those sorts of things that I understand if you had a bit of money and kids, you would do.
Right.
To help the kids be independent and autonomous and not come out with huge student loans.
Right.
So they are just playing catch up and correcting some of the traditional conservatory type ideas that are very strong in the culture. Traditional music teaching will have these ideas that you have to practice, you have to do scales, and it's all not true.
Mm.
It's not, because it's all kind of backwards.
Right. I can't play a scale on a guitar.
That's fine. I'm only redoing my scales on the piano because some of the kids, I've been told by their parents they have to do one of a NISMA exam, so they have to play scales for NISMA. Mm. So that's the only reason I'm doing them. But
I just want to go back to one other thing you said. You think everybody can, and if they aren't, it's because of their trauma.
Yes. Yeah.
I had one guy who I swear I couldn't do it, and now you said it's because of a trauma, and I'm like, yeah, this guy's traumatized. I can tell he's traumatized.
John, if someone has a flat speaking voice, they actually may have a physical problem with knowing pitches.
Right.
It's much more complex. Like, if you can't sing in tune, but
my
you...
My guy cannot sing in tune.
Now, listen. But you are a word person.
Mm-hmm.
And coincidentally are a professor of classics at a university, you are going to go with the rhythm and the pitch of the language, not the notation.
Mm. Mm.
So the classic one, somewhere, if you say somewhere, does it go up or down?
Somewhere.
Does it go up or down? So the most famous song goes up an octave, Somewhere Over the Rainbow.
Okay.
So that, an octave, as you probably know, is eight notes. Is a really huge interval.
Yep.
The natural word somewhere goes down.
Somewhere, right.
So the fact that one of the most famous songs
makes you, yeah.
Is incredibly difficult. So all your songs with words and music, you have to look at, is it a good marriage?
Mm.
So the two most brilliant songwriters, as far as I'm concerned, are
Don't embarrass me now.
Cole Porter and Irving Berlin.
Okay.
Because they wrote the words and the music.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else is a collaboration. And even though I'm not knocking Gershwin, who's another great, you know, he's writing with his brother. So it's a little, might be a little different. But it's the relationship between the words and the music.
Mm. That is.
So this is where it gets, you start realizing, oh, the reason perhaps this person doesn't sing very well in tune is because they're going with the music of the words, not the music of the song.
Right, right.
And as soon as you start putting that out to them, they get it.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'm going to write him. I hope he's not listening to this episode. So, I'm going to write him and tell him.
So
try that.
It's really interesting.
Yeah.
But if you have flat affect, which means no emotion, you might start hearing somebody talking. That may be a hearing problem.
Mm.
Very rarely.
Right.
Very rarely.
That might be him too, actually.
It's usually trauma.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like now this, I don't know how long they've been speculating, but they, one of the speculations about Beethoven going deaf was that his uncle just like smacked him around the head, which is what people did in those days. You know?
Right.
They still do it. But anyway, and that's what caused him to probably have an undiagnosed ear infection, which caused him to go deaf later years. But all his music was inside, so it didn't really matter.
That's one of my pet peeves about, or not pet peeves, but one of my observations about modern day songwriting is, like you say, pay attention to the marriage between the words and the music and how a word is spoken versus how it is sung. And I think I observe modern day songwriters stopping the minute they like something as opposed to making it better than what I like. I think what you like as a songwriter is too low a bar. I think you have to. I think that's the craft is taking what you like and making it better.
I think that's because you think writing and making things better is important. If you think just writing a song and selling it and making money, then you're not going to be particularly interested.
Right.
In improving your craftsmanship.
Right, right.
Because and then you're caught, so many of people in caught by what sells, what's cute, what's sexy, what's this, you know, what's branding, you know, and all of that stuff, you know, all the sell of stuff. And that's very tricky.
Why don't you write a book?
Because I don't write.
Why don't you hire somebody to write a book?
Because I'm not interested in doing it.
Yeah, but your philosophy would make a fantastic book.
I like talking to people, John.
But the book is a great card for talking to people.
No, I...
You can't talk to everybody. You can...
You may be surprised, John.
Okay. You're talking to everybody now, actually. So that's fine.
Yeah. So if you're talking about reaching more people, podcasts is the obvious one.
Yeah.
That's where I'd be going with that because it's connecting. So if I don't believe that there is more... Which means I'm interested, I'm curious, I'm wondering, all of those creative things about how can I do it better is not about playing faster notes.
Right.
It's about being able to shape it in a more musical way or to have, I actually have a student who actually is a genius. It's a bit stunning because... I'm not a techie person, but you know they all sort of say, oh, you get this app and it downloads and it's supposed to make your life easier.
Mm-hmm.
May or may not, who knows. this kid, you explain something to the kid, I can see the brain is just going, bang, there's a download, he can do it. It is unbelievable to see.
That's kind of cool.
It's unbelievable. It's nothing to do with hours of practice. It's no, you just talk to them.
Right.
That's why I say they're a genius.
You ever hear of
They're eight.
Yeah. You ever hear Lester Lemke? You ever hear of him?
No.
So I actually saw him in college. It's amazing.
Yeah.
Completely debilitated. Can't see, can't speak, can't blah, blah, blah. So
sounds like Stephen Hawkins.
Worse.
Yeah.
Worse.
Yeah.
One of those and
incredible disabilities.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so one day his and he was English and then came over here and toured. One day his mother's upstairs and she hears Beethoven and she's like, oh, I left the record player on. She goes downstairs and it's him doing it. And he can just like your guy, hears it once, gets it,
he can download
and just
it.
Go. Yeah, downloads it. Amazing. And you make my argument about shredding very well. I always say, like, you said people with fast fingers. And I say I can go on YouTube and watch 12 6-year-olds shred on an electric guitar.
Oh, God, yes. Of course.
I can't go on YouTube and watch anybody, 6-year-olds. 12, 6-year-olds play a classical guitar where you got to let a note ring and you got to let the guitar work.
And also the timing of it.
Yeah.
And all of those things.
Now, the only problem we have is we both like bluegrass, and bluegrass is shredding.
Yeah, but I don't want to spend 60 minutes. I don't want to listen to it for 60 minutes.
Oh, okay. Fair enough. Just a little bit. How do we hire you? Website?
Yes.
What's the website?
JudithMuir.com.
Spell Muir?
M-U-I-R.
Beautiful. And you're on Facebook if I want to dig you up that
way? Yes, yes. You can message me. My personal Facebook page tends to be videos of cats and horses and... the recent interpretation of some dance company or of the... ballet from the Dance of the Swans from Swan Lake, and it's all these little 3-year-olds, and it's absolutely brilliant. I think it looks like it's got Asian.
Oh,
and
wow.
It's so well done because the taller kids are doing it on their knees so the little 2-year-olds can run on their feet. It's just brilliant, you know. So yes,
right.
Yeah.
And do you give out a phone number or?
Yes, you can call me on 845-677-5871.
And if I'm a facility that wants to have you in to do a sing along, if I'm an adult that wants to return to music and do personal
absolutely
drama, if I'm a child that wants to, that needs exposure to music so I can pick my path, all the above.
Yeah, I'm very thrilled that I have a new kiddo. She's 5 and she has a big personality, which is good because mom has a big personality. And I think it'd be difficult to have a child that had a small personality if he had a big personality. This kid sings, this kid dances, and this kid creates. And it's just fantastic because grandma has a piano, so there's no pressure. So I can do singing with this kid. So we have a deal. I make sure that she can sing all the words to, you know, the Muffin Man, which of course we changed to the Muffin Girl. And
well done.
And then, of course, I've taught her Sing a Rainbow, which is very lovely. It's an Andy Williams song from the 50s.
Andy Williams had pipes,
You know, lovely song. So that she stands next to me and sings, so I make sure she's got all the words. And then she has to go and dance around the room. And I have a good 30-foot room, so it's great. And so then I can see how she moves. So we've got this great deal going. And then I show her 2 things on the piano. And then next week she comes in and says, her mummy showed me... Mummy showed me how to do this, this, and this, which is interesting because Mummy doesn't have a piano. Grandma has a piano, so I don't say a word. So she shows me all the things that she tells me Mummy has taught her, which I actually taught her. So because I have permission from both parents to be that creative with this child instead of, she has to have a keyboard. She has to have... No. So we can see where this is going.
Right.
Because as soon as you get into practice and making it not fun...
Mm-hmm.
Especially now because everyone's so used to instant downloads, they don't understand the concept of engaging with the instrument.
Right.
But she sings and she dances. And then she makes up unicorn songs, which is fine.
That's great.
And so I can be totally creative with her. Half an hour goes by in 2 seconds.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, because I have a contract that I can work with her creativity and not having to, quote, make her more and more formal.
Right.
So one of the analogies I say to parents is you have to be very, very you do things at a very superficial level in the beginning. You do a wide variety of things. And then bit by bit, it's like doing a PhD if you get one. You have to become more specialized.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't often do really specialized things with kids unless you unless you've had them for 3-4 years, because
mm-hmm.
It's too much for them, and and I never teach them to read until for about 3 or 4 years. Then they want to read,
right?
And then you got them.
But now they're in love, so they want
they're interested in reading, so they want to read.
Right,
reading music's complex. So
yeah, it is.
That usually is like when they're. I've worked with them for like 4 or 5 years, and they're like 10, 11, 12. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
What did I forget to ask you?
I have no idea.
Is there anything you wanted to cover that I didn't hit?
We can always do this again. I've got lots of things we can chat.
All right. Wonderful. All right. JudithMuir.com, Facebook, and say the phone number again, please.
845-677-5871.
Putting more music out in the world is a good thing. So thank
you. Yes, and helping community
with
the music.
Yeah.
And the intergenerational music programs and the Lifted Project. Inspiring our community is so, so needed.
Thank you for coming in here.
Pleasure.
All right. Talk to you guys later.